This program is a pre-recorded production of BBSRadio.com.
Deep Brain Radio.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Into each life, a little death must fall. But death is not the end of all things. There is life after death, so to speak, and we can prove it. When your spouse dies, you must continue to live, unless, of course, you're both taken out in a single accident, or you're suicidal. And if you are, well, listening to an internet radio program is not what you should be doing right now. The widow. The widower. The survivor must continue to survive alone. And for many, that is uncharted territory. Here on Deep Brain Radio, we hope to shed a little light and light a little hope. This is Deep Brain Radio on BBS Radio. Now here's your host, Bill Schmalfeld, to tell you about today's show.
Greetings, neighborinos. I'm Bill Schmalfeld, and I'm the host of this little twice-a-week clam bake that, for some reason or another, I call Deep Brain Radio. I really don't know why I call it that. Perhaps it's because I'm a man who has Parkinson's disease, who has undergone deep brain stimulation surgery, and because a lot of the focus of this show will be on the subject of aging, talking to experts in the field of medicine, alternative medicine, spiritual healing, what have you, about progressive neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's and so on, because the mind is a terrible thing. I'd like to interview psychologists, psychiatrists, experts in the field of mental health, or anyone else who'll talk to me about the grieving process, about the peculiar challenges of growing old alone, and how to deal with and process the death of a spouse. I dedicate this series of programs to my late wife, Gail Maureen Rice Balsarac Schmalfeld. I am a firm believer in the concept that everyone on the planet has a soulmate. It's the lucky person who finds his or her soulmate and has a happy life with that person. I am such a lucky person. You'll notice I didn't say was such a lucky person, because even though she's passed on, I still feel lucky. Let me tell you how we met. Pull up a chair. I had just broken up with my second wife. This was in 1988. I had moved from California to Milwaukee so I could be surrounded by my family instead of hers. After a few months, I decided I may as well go ahead and start dating again. I was only 33 years old and I had lots of living to do, if you know what I mean, and I think you do. So my late twin brother and I would hit some of the local dance bars on a Friday night, and Bob would serve as my wingman. On one such Friday evening in late February, Bob and I were in a club in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, called the Country Castle. I spied, with my little eye, at a table, two attractive women and one guy sitting right between them. I was particularly attracted to the blonde sitting at the table, a voluptuous, statuesque woman of pleasant visage. For the better part of the evening, I kept an eye on that table to see which of the women the lone guy was with. With my luck, I would have gone up to ask the blonde to dance, and it would turn out she was married to the guy at the table. Trouble like that I did not need, so I... But at no point did I get a good solid clue which of the chicks the dude was with. There was no obvious display of affection between the guy or either of the two girls. I was faced with a conundrum. I had a 50% chance of getting my face beaten unrecognizable if I walked up to the table and asked the blonde to dance with me. And then by later in the evening, I had danced with another woman, and she and I seemed to be more or less getting along. So she and I made a date to have a beer together that next evening. I do not remember that woman's name, not even her first name. I can't even remember what she looked like. All I can remember about that date is that she spent the entire evening talking about her children, which is fine. But then she starts laying down the law to me as if we were already in a relationship and not on our first date. She was telling me about what I could and could not do with her children and how I could and could not treat them. I could not start acting like their father. She was clear on that subject. They were her kids, and she would tell them what to do and what not to do, not some guy she met in a bar. Okay, I thought, that's reasonable enough. So I finished my beer and said goodnight, and I went home. Never saw that woman again, although she did call once, and I pretended I was busy. Fast forward a week. I'm waiting at a bus stop in downtown Milwaukee, and it starts to rain. I noticed there's a drugstore behind me with a magazine rack, so to get out of the rain, I went in and rifled through the magazines. One of them was titled Single Life, and it had pages and pages of local personal ads. Now, these were respectable personal ads, nothing sleazy about it. I took the magazine home, circled three or four ads, went to a photo booth, had my picture taken, and sent them along with introductory letters to the blind box ad addresses in each ad that I had chosen. All right, fast forward another week. At this point, I have a temporary job doing word processing for a large company in Milwaukee. I got a phone call at work from my soon-to-be ex-wife. It turned into an argument, and I hung up on her. A minute or so later, the phone rang. I assumed it was my ex calling to continue the argument, so I picked up the phone and I said one word. What? On the phone, silence. Now, before I continue, I want you to consider the old question of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? My entire future was hanging in the balance at this moment, and I did not even know it. Given the tone of my voice, I wouldn't have blamed the caller for just hanging up and not going through with it, but to my eternal gladness, she was brave and proceeded in a quiet voice, a cautious voice, to speak to me. She told me her name was Gail and that I had answered her personal ad in Single Life, and she asked if she had called at a bad time. I knew that if I was going to save the situation, it was time to turn on the charm and lay it on thick. I convinced her that I had just had an angry telephone exchange with someone, and I thought that this was that someone calling me back, but it turned out not to be that someone. It turned out to be her, so I apologized profusely and asked if we could just start the phone conversation all over again. So we set up a date to meet at a public place, in this case, the George Webb restaurant on South 13th Street, just north of Oklahoma Avenue. We'd meet that Friday at 8 p.m. And then she told me something that blew my mind. And the more I think about it as the years go by, the more I believe in destiny and Gail and I being destined to be together. Remember at the beginning of the story when I was discussing the two women and one guy I saw at the Country Castle dance bar? It turns out that Gail was the blonde that I had my eye on. The other girl was her sister, Nancy. The guy was Nancy's boyfriend, Mike. And what's more, according to Gail, she had her eye on me as well. But by the time she had worked up the courage to come over and ask me to dance, the other girl had already joined me, the one who spent the better part of the next night telling me how I would and would not deal with her children. In the literary world, we call this a twist in the plot. Now, I am nothing if not a cautious man. I called my brother Bob, told him about the date, and asked if he'd do me a favor, an extra special kind of wingman kind of favor. I asked him to situate himself at the country castle by 8:30 Friday night. I would bring Gail there after we met and be pleasantly surprised to see Bob there as well. We had this worked out to the finest detail. If the date took the same sort of turn that the previous date had taken, and I found myself spending time with a crazy woman from whom I needed to escape, I would ask Bob how his wife was feeling today. After all, she had been down with the flu for a few days, according to our story. Bob would then go to the payphone, call home, and see if she needed anything. He'd come back and tell me that her fever was up and she was out of Tylenol. He would ask me to give him a ride home, and I, of course, being a good brother, would agree to do so. But since he lived way out in West Dallas, we should probably take this nice lady home first and then make the ride out to his apartment. We were all set. 8 p.m., Friday, March 18th, 1988. I was seated at a table in the George Webb restaurant on South 13th Street, just north of Oklahoma Avenue. It was go time. A haggardly, leather jacket-wearing, bleached blonde with dirty hair and black roots walked into the restaurant. For a moment, I considered stabbing myself in the neck with one of the knives at the table at which I was seated, but I couldn't find a clean one. The urge passed quickly, though, when the nasty-looking woman left the restaurant without even so much as looking in my direction. Then, moments later, the door opened, and the most beautiful woman I have ever seen and would ever see in my life walked into the restaurant. It was magic. We sat in a booth, ordered coffee, chatted a while, and then we held hands as we walked to my car to go to the country castle, where my good wingman Bob was waiting. I took Bob aside and told him I didn't believe his services would be necessary that evening. Gail was, in every sense of the word, delightful. She was smart. She was funny. She was incredibly sexy. Within 2 weeks, we were living together. Then, on November 17th, 1989, we got married. The rest, as they say, is history. Now, as they say, every story, good story, bad story, happy story, sad story, there's a beginning and there's an end. I don't believe our story is ended yet. And I'll tell you why coming up. But first, here's a song I recorded for my wife last year while she was still living.
When I screw up, she sets me straight, keeps an eye on my spending of late, makes that face when I act the clown, there to remind me to put the toilet seat down. Well, what can I say? Sometimes a fella needs reminding. Keeps an eye peeled so I don't fall, when at my feet a dog tosses a ball. Always checks if there's something I need. She's my caregiver, a most wonderful breed. And by that, I mean a breed of human being. Not like comparing her to an animal or anything. For one thing, she'd... Well, you don't want to know. You don't like being called an animal. Who does? But let me tell you something about this girl, mister. She's one of a kind. She's my angel and she's my love. She was sent to me from heaven above. Insists I do all the things I can do. Her word's not subject to judicial review.
The ruling on the field still stands.
And she didn't even need to go under the hood to check the replay. Takes me places cause I can't drive. Does those things that I know keeps me alive. She can interpret my screwed up speech. Knows what I meant when a word's just out of reach. You know, she's just like my mom that way. Her and Dad knew each other so well that one would start to say something and the other would finish the sentence. My mom every now and then would say, John, would you let me finish what I was gonna say? And then she'd say what it was that he had just said. We're kinda like that. We know each other that well. Takes no nonsense and brooks no guff. Though she'll deny it, I swear, buddy, she's tough. She takes care of the things I can't. I feel wealthy, although money is scant. And I mean wealthy in a spiritual sense, not financial. Hell, certainly not financial. Been through good times, we've been through bad. I make her happy, at times I make her mad. One quarter century, best of my life. She's my caregiver, and better yet, she's my wife. And there ain't no other man living on the face of the earth can say that. I am married to the most wonderful woman God ever saw fit to put on the planet. And if you disagree with that, I'll meet you outside.
Everybody that ever knew Gail loved her, and no one more than I. You can find that song on my CD. Better yet, She's My Wife is the name of the song. The CD is called Nuts for Nitwits. It's available on Amazon, iTunes, and wherever quality digital products are sold. When we get back to the program here, I'll tell you the other side of the story. I've told you how we met, and now I'll tell you how we ended up going our separate ways for the time being.
Deep Brain Radio.
A true life telling of the parable of the widow's mite, author Bill Schmalfelt wanted to tell the world about his participation in a clinical trial to test the safety of deep brain stimulation in the early stages of Parkinson's disease. Yet, he wasn't able to appreciate the quiet charity through suffering unfolding in his own home until it was almost too late. The Widower's Mite by Bill Schmalfelt is a story of love, honor, respect, and making the transition from being cared for to caregiver. The reader will see how Bill came to realize what he had given by volunteering for surgery in a clinical trial was no big thing compared to the love and selflessness of his soulmate. There is beauty in deterioration, there is strength in weakness, and most of all, there is grace in the approach of death. The Widower's Mite, by Bill Schmalfelt, available in paperback and Kindle at Amazon.com and other online booksellers. You can also get a copy at www.deepbrainradio.com. The Widower's Mite. Read it, then hug somebody you love. Nothing lasts forever. Except love.
Brain Radio.
That's right, Deep Brain Radio, and we're on the air here on BBS Radio every Tuesday and Friday, 6 p.m. in the East Coast, 3 p.m. on the West Coast. That would be 5 p.m. here in God's country. I want to tell you a little bit about our upcoming show on Tuesday. Our special guest will be the Reverend Maria Dancing Heart Hoagland. We'll talk about her book, The Last Adventure of Life, in which she talks about, rather than viewing death as something to be feared, we can come to experience it as a beautiful and sacred event, not unlike a birth, something we can even look forward to when the time comes. The Reverend Maria Dancing Heart Hoagland, our guest on Tuesday's edition of Deep Brain Radio. 911, what's your emergency? Yes, sir. What do you see?
Well, there's something suspicious at the bus stop near Columbus Circle here.
And what would be suspicious, sir?
Well, again, you know, I'm not a mind reader, and you guys always say if you see something, say something. And I'm right across the street from this, so I thought you should know that there's a guy sitting at the bus stop. Looks like he could be one of those Muslims.
Muslim?
Yeah. Either that or one of those Hasidic Jews.
Sir, there's no law against being a Muslim.
Oh. I thought Congress had just...
No, they've only been talking about it, sir. Do you see an actual emergency in progress?
No, not yet, but I'll keep an eye on it.
Thank you, sir. 911, what's your emergency? Yes, sir.
Well, that Muslim, turns out he is a Muslim, because he's reading the Quran.
Yeah.
And he has a bag with him.
A bag, like a backpack or something?
No, sir, it's like a small paper bag.
I see. Is there anything particularly suspicious about the bag? Thank you, sir. We'll...
We'll 911,
what's your emergency?
Oh my God. It's me again from Columbus Circle. The Muslim guy with a long beard. Did I tell you he had a beard?
No, you failed to mention that. Well, sir, that's true. We'll send a squad right out to take a look at that.
No, he's coming back.
He is.
Yeah, he's sitting back down and opening the bag. And, oh my God, he's opening the bag. He's taking a sandwich out.
I see. That's hardly an emergency. Is he eating the sandwich, sir?
Yeah, but like I said, it could contain high explosives that he's going to set off and use himself as a suicide bomb.
That's highly unlikely, sir. Suicide bombers tend to wear their explosives in a vest. Sir, thank you for calling. Please don't use this line unless it's an emergency in the future.
Well, you guys are always saying it.
911, what's your emergency?
Me again here at Columbus Circle. I just wanted to let you know that the situation seems to have resolved itself up here. The Muslim guy was reading his Quran and eating his sandwich, and this big guy wearing like a flannel shirt and a hat with a Confederate flag on it, and he walked over there and sat down next to the guy and told him to get back to Kadukistan or wherever it was he came from. I thought there was going to be a fight for a minute, but the Muslim guy reached into his pocket and tried to hand the big guy a pamphlet, and he said, "Here, take this, put this in your backpack, read it later." And the big guy just swatted it out of his hand and said, "We don't need you or your kind here. Get your ass back to..." Oh, I'm sorry, I said ass. He said, "Get your ass back to Kadukistan or wherever it is you come from." And the Muslim guy just took a deep breath and got up and walked away. So everything looks fine.
Sir, this is the emergency line. This is not the everything is fine line.
Okay, well, I just want... Oh, wait. The big guy just left after taking something out of his backpack and putting it in the garbage can. That's a perfectly good crock pot. I better go get him. Hey, mister, you forgot your...
Deep Brain Radio.
Bill Schmalfeld here again. Thanks for joining us on our premiere episode of Deep Brain Radio here on bbsradio.com. If you were to ask me 2 years ago which one of us would die first, me or Gail, the answer would have been an unequivocal me. I had Parkinson's disease by that point, 14 years, by now 16. My health has been failing, although my systemic health is okay, but I've already outlived the average lifespan of a guy with Parkinson's disease. I don't have the figures right here in front of me right now, but I've read somewhere that 10 to 14 years is considered a good length of time to live with a diagnosis of Parkinson's, and as of the end of January, I'll be at 16 years. So I always thought, I never doubted for a moment that I would die before Gail. Gail said she wasn't having any of that. She said that she had already gone through that once with her first husband, and she was not going to go through that with a second husband, especially one she loved as much as she loved me. She was bound and determined, short of suicide, that she would be the first one to shuffle off the mortal coil, and that I would be the one left behind this time. And I didn't really start believing that it was going to happen until probably February or March of this year. We both knew we had physical problems. Gail was aware of her long battle with scleroderma. And to put something of a political spin on it, as Gail and I would sit and watch the news together, and we were both quite the news junkies. MSNBC was pretty much on the TV all day. We'd read or hear or see of something terrible happening in the world, and either I or Gail would make a comment about how it just seems like the whole world is going to hell. And I would pat Gail on the knee and say, "Don't worry about it, babe. We'll both be dead soon." But she was bound and determined to beat me out the door. She survived cancer twice in her life. Once before I met her, she had cervical cancer and had an almost total hysterectomy. They left one ovary. And then in 2012, she was diagnosed with squamous cell carcinoma in the space formerly occupied by her left tonsil. And she had surgery for that. She had her lymph nodes on the left side of her neck stripped out and examined, and she was declared cancer-free. She didn't need any chemo. She didn't need any x-ray, which she couldn't have had anyway because of her scleroderma. But she was declared cancer-free. In 2014, she started to lose weight rather rapidly. She went from a high in the early 2000s of just around 300 pounds down to about 160 or so by late 2013. And at the time, we thought it was a great thing. She had shed all these pounds without even really trying. Examination after examination showed her to be cancer-free. So we just took it as a good thing that the weight was coming off. Her blood tests always came back normal. Everything normal, except she was losing weight and had scleroderma. By mid-2014, it was obvious she was losing too much weight. She was down to about 140 at this point and was starting to look skeletal. The last photo of us taken side by side was on January 6th, 2015, and she just looked terrible. She was skin and bones, but still functioning. She was weaker, she was wobblier, she was at the point to where I had to take over the taking out the dog's duty because the dogs could easily yank her off her feet, whereas if I held on to the rails on the porch, I was pretty much an immovable object. And more of the weight came off. In March, we went to the doctor together, and the blood tests were starting to show liver enzyme and kidney difficulties. But our doctor told us that there was really nothing to worry about, that this was all part of the natural process of aging, and she had been diagnosed with scleroderma since 1999, so there had to be some sort of damage going on. But Gail refused to go to the hospital. She would not let me take her to the ER until the very end. And I'll spare you the grisly details, but the beginning of the end was over the Memorial Day weekend in 2015 when she woke up and it was obvious from her condition that she needed to get to a hospital. They thought that she had ovarian cancer because of the fact that her abdomen was filled with fluid. And that's generally, for a woman, the reason for what they call ascites, the fluid in the abdomen. So they drained a liter and a half of fluid out of her and tested the fluid. No cancer. Wasn't a cancer cell to be seen. So everybody starts scratching their heads. What could it be? And I said, hey, she's had scleroderma since 1999. So more blood tests, ultrasounds, the whole nine yards. And now the tests were coming back showing critical damage to her kidneys. And her liver was failing. And there was nothing anybody could do. Dialysis was out of the question because, A, she had scleroderma. B, dialysis is a standby method employed for folks who are waiting for a kidney transplant for which she would never be eligible. The liver, same story. She would not be eligible. So after almost a week in the hospital, we decided that the best thing to do was just take Gail home, and they set up a home hospice for us. I mean, these guys gave us everything we needed. We had a hospital bed for Gail. We had something to lift her out of the bed with. She had her own bedside porta potty. Practically everything you could think of, medication, all of that paid for by my insurance. Gail, for her part, was thrilled to be home. Her first day home, she was chirping like a little bird, scooting around on her wheelchair, you know, pushing herself around on one foot, wiping off the counters in the kitchen and stuff like that because, you know, I wasn't doing it. And she just said she wanted to feel useful. She wanted to do something, but that lasted one day. The next day, we put her in a wheelchair, and it became obvious that the loss of her control of her bodily functions was going to prevent any such further expeditions. So the hospice nurse came by, prescribed something to stop that sort of thing. They catheterized her as well. And for the first few nights of her final week at home, I told her that I would cherish that time for the rest of my life. She was still lucid. She was not in great pain. We talked and talked and talked all night sometimes. I brought my bed out to the living room so I could roll it right side by side with her bed. And we'd hold hands over the bed rail talking to each other about the great things we had done, the places we had been, the things we had seen, and how deeply in love we were with each other, and how it almost never happened if she had just followed her first instinct and hung up the phone when I answered angrily. We would have never met. She felt her life was enriched by knowing me. I know my life was enriched by knowing her. Her last words to me were the evening before she passed. By this point, she was moaning with every exhale. And we didn't have any liquid morphine, nor could we find any in any local pharmacies, so the hospice nurse showed me how to dissolve small morphine pills in water and administer via like an eyedropper. And Gail would cooperate with that, but she was pretty much in a coma most of the time, in and out. So I had to wake her to give her this medication. And after I gave her the liquid solution, I told her that I loved her with all my heart and I always would. And it was hard to make out. It was more of the pattern of the words than actually hearing them. But she said, "I love you too, Punkin." That night, like I said, she was moaning with every exhale. She had stopped responding to any kind of stimulus. And by 6 in the morning on June 17th, the moaning had been replaced by what the end-of-life technicians tell you is something called the death rattle. It's no discomfort at all to the patient. They're not aware of it. But let me tell you something. Once you've heard it, you never want to hear it again. She hung in there until about 20 to 9 that morning, and she took in a last breath, let it out. No change in her expression, nothing dramatic. She was gone. I felt for a pulse, there was none. I told her how much I loved her. I kissed her, and then I called the hospice nurse, who came out and officially officially pronounced her dead. And I was told that the anatomy gifts registry people would be there within the hour. See, that's something both Gail and I have done, and I recommend you do the same if you're interested in the furtherance of medical science. When you've died and your spirit is out of your body, what's left? That was not Gail laying there in that bed. It was the vehicle Gail had been using for almost 62 years to get around from place to place. Gail was gone. So we both, some years ago, signed up for the Anatomy Gifts Registry, by which our entire bodies are donated to medical science. They use what they can use and cremate the rest. I was left alone with Gail. They said they'd be there within the hour. It actually took more like almost 4 hours for them to show up. But when they did show up, oddly enough, you know, I had just sat there watching my wife die. But I could not bear the thought of watching them lift my wife from the bed where rigor mortis had obviously would have had to have started to set in by that point. I would not be able to stand that. So I waited in the office for them to finish their job. They got her in the plastic bag and on the gurney and strapped her on and went through the door. And that's when I went out and I spoke to the nice lady from the funeral home that was delivering Gail to the Anatomy Gift Registry. And she gave me a hug and I watched as the hearse pulled away from my front steps. And I watched until I couldn't see the hearse anymore. And then I went back in the house. I stood there and I just looked at all the hospice equipment. It would take them days to come and collect all that stuff. I just stood there and thought, okay, now what? And to a large degree, that's what this show is going to be about. Now what? John Cougar Mellencamp sang it. Life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. I feel like I've got at least, I mean, barring an accident, I've got at least a decade left in me. My mom outlived my dad for 30 years. So do I want to do that? Well, not really. But I don't have a choice. My life is not my decision. Those are decisions that are made at a higher pay grade than mine. So what I'll do is use my time and some of the insurance money I received from my federal employment benefits to do this radio show on BBS and talk about the things we learn from living alone. And yes, this is the first time in my entire life that I have lived by myself. I'll tell you more about that coming up.
Deep Brain Radio.
Since my wife died in June, I find myself living alone for the first time in my life. Even as a fetus, I did not have the luxury of a uterus to myself, as I am an identical twin. For those first 9 months of life, if you believe life begins at conception, I had to share mom's uterus with my equally large twin brother. At that time, when I was born in 1955, we had a mama, a dad, one older sister, one older brother. So Bob and I had jumped into an already crowded house. It would become even more crowded over time with the addition of a little brother in 1957, a little sister in 1962, and another little sister in 1964. So right after high school, I was in the Navy, living in barracks, surrounded by other people. While I was in the Navy, I got married. So when I got out of the Navy for the first time in 1977, I had a wife already, so I did not live alone. Then came son number one, followed by daughter number one, a house full of people again. In 1981, I rejoined the Navy, living first in the barracks with, again, other people, and then in a ship with other people, and Then, getting divorced and living in the barracks. In 1983, I remarried and got out of the Navy in 1985. So in 1985, it was a family, wife number two, daughter number two, son number two, and then in 1987, daughter number three. Once again, a crowded house. When wife number two and I broke up in 1988, I moved in with my twin brother and his wife and two daughters for a little while. And then I stayed at the Milwaukee YMCA for about a week. And that was really the only time in my life I lived alone. After about a week, my mom asked me to move in with her until I got my feet on the ground. I met Gail in 1988. We got married in 1989, and that came with Gail's kids. Once again, crowded house. The older child grew up, moved out. Gail and I moved out on our own after TJ graduated high school, but I still did not live alone. Eventually, Gail's youngest son moved in with us, and then, last June, Gail died. Since then, I've moved out of our house in Maryland and now reside in a little apartment in Milwaukee, and I'm learning. I learn every day. There are benefits and drawbacks to living alone. Here are some of the things I'm learning, and I'll start with the benefits. One, the air in this apartment belongs to me. I pay for it. I am the only one breathing it. Therefore, when I fart, there is no need to say excuse me or to make any attempt to disguise or silence the sound. The walls may be thin, but they're not that thin. Two, I now have time to work on projects uninterrupted without anyone asking me what the hell do I think I'm doing. For instance, my current priority experiment, which will benefit single mankind everywhere, is to see how long it takes for my dirty clothes to clean themselves through the process of chemical oxidation. The theory is simple, but I don't think it's really ever been tested. The hypothesis is that soiled clothing placed in a pile will generate its own heat source. The fermentation of the filth in the clothes toward the bottom of the pile, compounded by the weight and pressure put on by the clothes on top of the pile, it's bound to create a reaction, and the clothing at the bottom of the pile will be cleaned first as a result of the chemical oxidation. My job is to test the pile once a week to make sure the clothes on the bottom do not burst into flame. A quick sniff test lets me know how well the experiment is proceeding, but as of the moment, results are inconclusive, and that's what Febreze is for. Number three. My late wife was a firm believer in the concept of a place for everything and everything in its place. I say bullshit. Things belong where I leave them. That way I know where to find them. If I use the aluminum foil and leave it on the counter, I can see it from my chair in the living room. That way, should I suddenly find myself needing to cover something with aluminum foil, I don't need to wonder where it is. When I do the dishes, and a brief footnote here, the chemical oxidation experiment did not work on the dishes at all. All the remaining food on the dishes actually became part of the ceramic of the dish, causing me to have to purchase new dishes. I tried again with enamel dishes, and while the food itself did not molecularly bind with the enamel, it did harden into a super glue-like substance that was impossible to scrape off. So after wondering for a day or two if it was safe to eat mashed potatoes on a plate with two previous servings of mashed potatoes hardened into a moonscape of mashed potatoes covering the surface of the enamel plate, I abandoned the experiment and purchased a third new set of dishes, which I wash from time to time. End of footnote. Anyway, I was talking about the fact that when I do the dishes, I don't put them right away. Nor do I dry them. Drying dishes is a waste of time. Let them sit in the dish drainer until they're dry. And then don't bother cleaning out the dish drainer until you do the dishes again. You're saving yourself time and effort, and you'll be grateful for all that extra time later. Number four. I am no longer compelled to put the toilet seat down. As a man in my early 60s, I do number one far more often than I do number two. So it is a time-saving measure to not have to drop the toilet seat, only to have to pick it up next time. I'm smart enough to know that I must check the seat before I sit to make sure it's down. It only took three times of nearly falling into the toilet to learn that important lesson, but I learned it on my own. 5. I dust the furniture and vacuum at the point where the dust and dirt reaches the point to where it annoys me or interferes with my breathing. Generally, I figure the chances of the president, the pope, or Queen Elizabeth dropping by at any given time is slim at best. Of course, if I know they're coming, I'll clean up ahead of time. I mean, that's just a courtesy. But if they surprise me and just drop in, they take what they get. I'm a widower. Of course, as I mentioned, there are drawbacks above and beyond the fact that I've lost the love of my life and not a moment goes by in the day where I do not grieve her and miss her and mourn her untimely departure, but this is an essay about living alone for the first time in your life and not so much about being a widower, so let's talk about those drawbacks. 1. There's nobody to turn to and ask, "Does this smell funny to you?" when that jug of milk seems like it's going south. 2. If you're on the john and there's a knock at the door, well, they're just going to have to wait till I'm done. I don't care if it's a special delivery. I'm making a special delivery in here. I'm sure there are more drawbacks than just the two I've mentioned, but I do believe I need to cut this short. I can see tendrils of smoke coming up from the laundry basket, and it smells like it might be time to abandon another scientific experiment which would have benefited all single mankind everywhere. Now I just have to find a fire extinguisher.
You have been listening to Deep Brain Radio on BBS Radio with your host, Bill Schmalfeld. You can reach Bill through his website, www.deepbrainradio.com. where Bill gladly accepts your generous donations. You can also find him on Twitter at Deep Brain Radio. If you'd like to find out how you can host your own show, log on to bbsradio.com. This program is jointly owned by Bill Schmalfeld and BBS Radio. All rights reserved.
Make sure you join us on Deep Brain Radio Tuesday at 6 p.m. East Coast, 3 p.m. West Coast, as our guest will be Maria Dancing Heart Hoagland. She'll talk about her book, The Last Adventure of Life, Inspiring Approaches to Living and Dying, and I know that's going to be a very interesting conversation. So, see you then. Have a great weekend.
We hope you enjoyed the show half as much as you would have
if it had been twice as good.